The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories. From World War II...
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
...to the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles.
Our guest this week is Alfred Shehab, retired U.S. Lieutenant Colonel from the United States Army. He's a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge. Sir, an honor to have you with us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Let's start at the beginning. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Cape May, New Jersey. I guess you could say I was raised in New York because we spent our winters there, but I always recognized Cape May as home, to the point where when I enlisted in the Army and they asked me my hometown newspaper, I said the Cape May Star and Wave, which comes out once a week, and I still get it. On both sides of the family, I had several cousins. One of them unfortunately ended up in the Pacific, and I'm glad I didn't get there.
When did you enlist?
I reported for duty on the 10th of January, 1942.
So this is just a 1 month after Pearl Harbor?
Yes. I always wanted to be a soldier. When the Bolsheviks invaded Finland, I volunteered to go over and help the Finns fight. I was 17, and the fellow of the Treasury Department, when I went there for a passport, suggested I go home. So I did. And when the Free French Movement started, I volunteered, and de Gaulle's men in New York had gone through Saint-Cyr at the French West Point with a cousin of mine. And even though the French beheaded their king, they were very class conscious, and they commissioned me a sub-lieutenant because I had had prior training in the Army had a citizen military training corps where you go to camp for 1 month each summer, and after 4 summers take the Series 10 exam. If you passed, you were commissioned in the reserves. I had 3 summers with the horse cavalry up at Ethan Allen, Vermont. And then the federal, National Guard and Reserves were federalized. That program stopped, but at least I knew my left foot from my right foot. But I got as far as Canada. The British were going to handle my passage, and I was to go up to Canada to Halifax to sail out of there. Well, I was alerted 4 times, and the alert was canceled 4 times. In 1941, the U-boats were sinking everything in sight. The 5th time the ship I was assigned to came in to Halifax. So I got up to Montreal on my way, and then a friend of the family turned up that morning at breakfast and announces how my father found out about this expedition of mine, and I was to go home. And I told him, no, I'm a sub-lieutenant. And she said, no, you're not. He called the CA and everything's off. So I went home and went down to Whitehall Street, New York, and enlisted.
And where did they send you for training?
Fort Knox, Kentucky. Fort Knox had become the armor center, but it was staffed by cavalry officers and NCOs because they were trying to get the Army mechanized. And so I went through officer candidate school there, and I was commissioned in the United States Cavalry.
And when were you sent to Europe?
1944, July 1944. I went over as a replacement officer. I'd been to certain schools, and I had served in the 4th Armored initially, and in the 16th Armored later, and in the 11th Cavalry. And when I saw wax landing in France, I figured that was it. So I volunteered and got shipped over and got assigned to the 38th Cavalry Squadron. Later on, they called it the Lucky 38th. It was a reconnaissance unit. They had just gotten through the Battle of St. Lo, and incidentally, they were the first American unit into Paris. Now, the American Army held up to let the 2nd French Armored Division under Leclerc liberate their Paris. But apparently headquarters wanted the Seine River bridges. And we were sent in. An A troop was the first group in. But it was difficult getting to the bridges because the people just all over the place. They were pulling our lads out of the tanks and armored cars and everything. And it took us a couple of days to sort of get reorganized, get set.
They liked you.
They were happy to see us then. Things changed when de Gaulle got in.
And so once Paris was liberated, that's August of 1944.
Yes.
Where did the 38th go then?
Well, we went into Luxembourg, Belgium. We did a great deal of patrolling in the Belgian, in Saint-Vith, Butenbach, Elsenborn, all those places. And then we went into, we were sent up to Monschau, which is in Germany. And we were there for quite a while. Decision was made to give Montgomery all the gasoline. If you saw that movie Patton, Montgomery was getting the gasoline, so the American Army sort of slowed down a bit. I was lucky. I was given 1,300 yards to be concerned about. But I found a hunting lodge in the edge of the woods, and we moved into it. And I had my outpost, so a lad would spend one night on an outpost and two nights back at the hunting lodge. The patrolling continued every day. We'd send out patrols. I lost one man on one of those patrols. Well, that was it, until the night of the 15th of December, when Junkers 88s were flying around and people were dropping out of them and we were shooting at them. I had an M1 that I grabbed. I had the 50s on the armored cars open up, and I had a call from squadron paratroopers in your area. Well, I told the fellow that called the S3, yes, we're quite familiar with the paratroopers in our area, and I said, well, get them, clean them out. And I had a platoon of 30 men. I don't know how many paratroopers they dropped. But anyway, we captured several, and when the lads found out each one was carrying a bottle of rum, they all volunteered to go out after the paratroopers, but we held them down a bit. And the next morning, to put it bluntly, all hell broke loose. Germans opened up with everything they had. And that was the start of the Battle of the Bulge. There were about 1 million men involved in the Battle of the Bulge. I think the Germans had 500,000. We had 600,000. And there are figures on how many tanks were involved and all that sort of thing. And the Malmedy massacre. That was interesting in that we all received a piece of paper, a very slim piece of paper, and all it said was, on such and such a date, I think it's 125 American prisoners of war were massacred by the Germans. It didn't say, don't surrender, nor did it say, kill all your German prisoners. It just made a blanket statement. We had quite a fight on our hands. As an example, I was moved out of my area. The 9th Division, 48th Regiment, started down through the woods from Eupen, which was Corps headquarters. They had been told that we were out of action. And one of my lads reported noise back in the woods, and we went out there and found it was an American outfit. So I invited the company that I ran into to come and join us in the CP and the hunting lodge. Of course, we had lost part of it in the bombardment. And then I was moved to an old mill closer to town, to Monschau. So I had my outposts, and one evening the lads called and said a patrol was coming through, a German patrol. And I told them, let them come in. And the patrol pulled up in front of the building we were in, which had holes in it, of course. And I had a 50 caliber mounted in a vise in the second story window, so we killed all 14 of them. I think their ambition was to get up the hill and cut the main road up there. See, we were not fighting the type war we fight today, where there are kids out there. Well, we did fight kids, yes. Hitler had kids 14 and 15 years old in uniform. We were the only units on the Siegfried Line in that area. When the attack came, everything below us caved in, and as a result, you ended up with a bulge. Some of the units that had gone in, the 106th Division, were just put there to acclimate it to combat conditions. And they suffered. They had, I would say, about 50% casualties. You know, as you think about it all later, it was a good thing because it really shortened the war. This fellow Hitler was the best thing going for us. That idiot decided he was going to get down to Antwerp and divide the British and the Americans and have a port there and get all the supplies and all that. And he took units from the Eastern Front where he really needed them. And all the new tanks they were coming out with, everything. He just constituted this large force under some of his top generals. I had 1,300 yards. That's all I was concerned about. I didn't know what was going on elsewhere. Communications broke down. It wasn't until much, much later. We never talked about it after the war, the Battle of the Bulge. That was another battle. It became a very important factor in the whole war in Europe in the sense that this fellow just blew it. Right. He lost all of that equipment. The interesting thing is they did not have the logistics to sustain them, but they were planning on capturing our POL dumps and all that sort of thing.
So Shehab, we'll be right back on Veterans Chronicles with Battle of the Bulge veteran, Lieutenant Colonel Alfred Shehab.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
We're back on Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. Our guest today is retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Alfred Shehab. He is a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge, specifically the 38th Cavalry Reconnaissance Squadron. And, sir, one of the things I know about from your writings on this very difficult time in December of 1944 is how thin your defenses really were as you tried to hold off the Germans. How thin were they, and how did you deal with that?
Well, for our front, for our squadron front, we had 9,000 yards. The squadron had 28 officers and 800 men. So every unit in the squadron had broken down into three recon troops, a tank troop, and a howitzer troop. So the entire squadron was on the line. No reserves because of the amount of ground we were holding. And during that period, of course, we had patrols going on all the time on all fronts. Now, we had some support, if I remember correctly, the 62nd Armored Field Artillery Battalion. When the main attack hit, they hit our troop headquarters. Joe Sain was the troop commander. And he had cooks going, firing, all the admin fellows that run things for us. They were all involved in it. And, of course, we did not know about the units on our right and left. I know that the 3rd Platoon of the Essex Troop was on my left, and I'd visit with Lieutenant Dixon every now and then. He'd come down and visit with me. But beyond that, we didn't know anything about divisions, and we knew we were under 5th Corps, but we didn't know that the 106th had come in recently into the line to acclimate them. The trouble is they really took a beating, and there were several other divisions involved in that sort of thing. And in that movie, Patton, where he goes to this meeting with Eisenhower and Bradley and the British and all that, and he's asked if he could do anything, and he said, I could have my people going right now. And Beadle Smith, who was Eisenhower's chief of staff, indicated, look, let's get reasonable. Oh, this is real. Well, Patton was a soldier. He was a tactician. When he left his headquarters, he told the lads, plan for a turnabout of the whole army to get to Bastogne. They already started planning it. And he got there. As far as I'm concerned, Patton was the best general we had in the Army. He knew war, he understood war, and he knew how to fight it. Anyway, to get back to the level or the number of troops or anything, I hadn't any idea. Later on, I found out from that sketch I just showed you how many the size of the German attack, how many troops were involved, and then of course how many of our people were in that same area, stretched out pretty well.
This seems like the first major combat you were in, and you were in command of soldiers beneath you. It's one thing, of course, to receive orders in battle. It's another one to give them. Explain what that was like.
Well, to begin with, we had to patrol. I would go to squadron or back to troop to get my instructions. Now, between getting my instruction and getting back to my platoon, I'm trying to figure who am I going to send, how large a patrol, and what's the area we have to cover. And, of course, we were always looking for prisoners. And at times we were lucky. We picked some up. Other times we ran into opposition. What I used to do is get an FO, we had a forward observer, and I would sit with him and the map showing the route I was going to take through the woods and establish checkpoints. So if we got hit or ambushed, I could holler for artillery on checkpoint number 4, as an example. This is what helped us in our patrols, but after getting my instructions, all this is going through my mind. I was lucky. I had an outstanding platoon sergeant, Sergeant McDonald, an outstanding scout sergeant, Sergeant Souza. And I had other lads that, we were all about the same age, except for one man, old man Leach. He was 38 years old. I don't know how he got into a recon unit. And so you're not initially concerned with, are we going to get into something? Are we going to get ambushed? Are we going to get killed? No. What you're concerned about is figuring out the route you had to go, what were you after, and what cover could you get out of it or prepare for. So the only time you would have any trepidation about anything would be afterwards, after you got back. If you had run into something, you're too busy. After you get back, you get a cup of coffee or something, and you start thinking about what place. Well, you may have different feelings, such as, well, thank God that's over, or how did I get out of that one, or whatever.
Colonel Shehab, we'll take another quick break here. When we come back, we'll conclude our conversation here on Veterans Chronicles.
Okay.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.
I'm Greg Corumbus. This is Veterans Chronicles. Our guest this week is retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Alfred Shehab. He's a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge and the 38th Cavalry Reconnaissance Squadron. Sir, as this battle went on for days, you mentioned a moment ago in the previous segment that you didn't think about the larger picture during combat, but at the end of the day, you had that opportunity. As the battle went on, did you feel like you were going to be able to hold the position, or did you feel like it might slip away?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I was moved out of the area I was in, across from the town of Kansan, down closer to Manchow. And then, as things eased up in our sector, I was called in and told to take a platoon patrol, my entire platoon, to the town of Hammer, which meant penetrating the Siegfried Line. We could see pillboxes and all that sort of thing. That gave me some concern. So I arranged for whatever I could for support by artillery, and I called my group together and told them what we were going to do and so forth, because we're going to go on through to the town of Hammer, which is a German town, through the woods, and we don't know what's facing us. But we started. I used to carry a swagger stick. The first patrol I ever went on, I carried an M1 rifle and the ammunition. It's heavy. Then I carried a submachine gun, and I carried a carbine. I figured the hell with it. I'll carry a swagger stick at my .45, and if we get ambushed, somebody gets killed, I'll use his weapon. I found out later, whenever we went out on patrol, if the lads saw the stick, they figured another Boy Scout hike. This time, I was so concerned about what I was getting into that I forgot the stick. And my platoon sergeant came up, he said, "Lieutenant, where is it? What are you talking about? Your bat, where is it?" So he sent one of the troopers to get it, and we went on. We passed fires that were smoldering. We passed pillboxes that, thank God, were empty. We were going 2.5 days. We finally got to Hammer. They were happy to see us. We were more happy to see them. And then the vehicles turned up. I had a platoon of 3 M8 armored cars. Each our car had a 37 millimeter with a coax 30 and a 50. I had 2 half tracks with 60 millimeter mortars, 4 Jeeps. My Jeep had a 30 cal machine gun on the hood. The other 3, I put 50s on pedestal mounts because the Germans didn't like the 50s. So our vehicles turned up. The next step was to cross this river. It was snowing like hell, and they told us that the 2nd Ranger Battalion had built a footbridge. They told them we had built a footbridge. We all waded the river up to your neck, holding your weapons up, and as soon as we got to the other side, we got into a firefight. And the firefight ended as quickly as it started, and was just frozen. It was cold. It was cold as hell, and snow was waist deep. Finally, our vehicles turned up, and frankly, I had my armored car. I put a tarp on the snow, took my wet clothes off, and put dry. That's one of the good things being in a mechanized unit. You can carry clothes with you. The infantry in the Battle of the Bulge, standing in those foxholes, the snow or ice melting during the day, trench foot was a serious problem. Not for us. We had our clothes. We could change our socks 6 times if we wanted to, which was an important element. So by then, we were started into Germany. during a period of time, we went through the towns of Halle, Magdeburg, and Leipzig. We met the Bolsheviks on the Elbe at Torgau. That was quite an exercise, meeting those birds. It was really something.
Tell us about it.
And the 69th Division made the initial contact, and we came up. Now, the roads were packed with German civilians getting away from the Bolsheviks, to the point where a couple times we just cut loose with the 50 calibers and fired in the air to get them out of our way. And, of course, we welcomed the Russians, and they welcomed us. And the next day we crossed the Elbe. The Russian Guards commander had a big dinner set up, or lunch. They took tables out of the houses and set them up in the middle of the street. And behind every one of us was a Russian female soldier to fill the glasses. So I had a glass in front of me with what looked like water. And I'm a teetotaler. I have more booze in the house than the average person. I just don't drink. I don't like the stuff. And I stuck my tongue in that and realized this was vodka. And, of course, the Russian Guards commander gets up, hooray to Roosevelt, and you downed it. Well, I dumped mine. And the girl filled it again. And then our general got up, hooray for Stalin. And I dumped it. Finally, she poked me. She brought a pail and put it next to me. So it was quite a party. A lot of headaches later. The Russians, I guess, had downed some olive oil or something. So we spent a couple days there and then continue our trek. And we went through Nuremberg. Oh, in a big forest outside Nuremberg, there were several hundred civilian cars, and I found a 1941 convertible Buick. So I had a lad get in and put it in our convoy, and we took it into Czechoslovakia. And squadron headquarters ended up in Prestige, about 10 miles south of Pilsen. And each troop was given an area, and the area I was given was Dolny Lukovitz, and there was a chateau there. So we moved into the chateau. And that was an easy life, but the war had stopped. The Czechs greeted us. And again, I keep referring to the Patton Museum because it supports what I'm saying, the Patton movie. There was a big parade in Pilsen, and Patton was there, and Czech generals and American generals and all that. And Bob Hope had come to Pilsen with the Diamond Horseshoe Show, and he had 16 ladies. The Diamond Horseshoe Show, yes. And one of them I knew. So I invite her out the chateau for lunch, and she said, gee, that's great. Why don't you invite all 16 of the girls, which we did. And Bob Hope laughingly said, what are you doing with all my women? Well, it turned out for the parade, I did not have enough troops to fill the vehicles. So we put field jackets on the girls and helmets. And I told the one that I put in my car, armored car, to just sit in the gunner's seat and don't move. That I'm standing in the car commander's seat, saluting as we went by the reviewing stand. And you know how sometimes you sense something? The young lady taking the helmet off, she's standing there, hair blowing, waving at the generals. Later I was told that I was lucky the war was over. But then, now we did Marlene Dietrich, a great, well-known actress, came and spent time with our outfit. And when the Bolsheviks found out about it, they wanted to come visit and meet her. So we have a picture of Marlene with this barbarian and our squadron commander. And so we were there for quite some time. When it was time to leave, the Czechs, almost on bended knee, don't go. If you go, we're finished, because the only organized group in Czechoslovakia was the Communist Party. And of course, we said, oh, no, the Russians are our buddies. Now, Patton wanted to... Patton knew what we were getting into. He wanted to go ahead and fight the Russians. We had many German surrender, units surrender, and they would say, we'd be very happy to join you. We'll go fight the Russians. I carried a light colonel's leaf in my pocket because a regimental commander wouldn't surrender to a lieutenant, but he'll surrender to a half colonel. And when we saw a large group coming, I put it on and tell them, well, just keep going that way. And then we radio back, a couple thousand men armed are coming your way. They've surrendered, but they're still armed. So we spent quite a bit of time, and we walked out of Czechoslovakia. Well, I won't get it. You know, this is after the fact. This is years later, and I've read books and seen movies on some of the big three getting together. Churchill suddenly realized that this bird Stalin had his own agenda, and he did. And so that's how we got into the Cold War. And subsequently, I ended up joining the 14th Cavalry in the late 50s, which was on the east-west border of Germany, patrolling the border. And I spent 4 years doing that in the Cold War.
You mentioned earlier that at the time, of course, you didn't realize the battle you were in at the Bulge was part of one of the most consequential battles, mm-hmm. not only of World War II, but of the 20th century. Looking back on it and knowing what a critical role you played in such a historic event, what comes to mind?
The only thing I think about is this. We never talked about it. While I was on active duty, we never talked about it. I don't know when it suddenly became a big deal. I rather suspect the books that were written, all that sort of thing, sort of brought out that this was really the largest land battle the United States has ever been in, with 81,000 casualties. And that's a lot of casualties. But my part in it was just a pea in the pot. Old sport, Hitler just threw all this stuff in and lost it all. So once we got going, after that, the going was fast. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'd go for hours without any stop or rest. Stop long enough to eat a K-ration or gas up, especially. The destruction of Germany by the bombers, you could look at it, it was unbelievable. We went through a concentration camp.
Which one?
I don't. Okay. It was so fast, I don't remember. Sure. But all I know is I looked at, this up here would not accept that one man would do it to another. Bodies piled like cordwood, men, women, and children. What kind of people would do that? From what I understand, civics is no longer a subject that's taught. The founding of this country, what does that flag stand for? How did we become a United States? Who were the people involved? What does this country stand for? The kids don't get into that anymore. They may see a movie, but they don't. As a matter of fact, I have found when I give a talk on the Battle of the Bulge at one of our youth leadership conferences, I'll ask, how many of you have seen that movie, Patton? Not that many hands. Some of the kids with military parents have seen it. So I'm concerned, that the young people do not understand the liberties that they have, what it has taken for them to enjoy these liberties, because we don't seem to get into that anymore in school. What does our flag stand for? Most of them don't know. The Star Spangled Banner is played, and they shimmy around. They don't know, put their hand over their heart as a token of respect to the flag and to the liberties that it represents. Now, I guess when I was younger, I would have said that's a lot of hogwash, but not anymore because I'm a lot older, wiser, I think. There's something lacking, and we try to help with youth leadership conferences. I belong to the military order of World Wars that Pershing pushed for. It's made up of officers, active, retired, and so forth, and our two missions in life patriotic education and national security. And with patriotic education, we support ROTC. We have youth leadership conferences for the youngsters. We talk about liberty. We talk about what it means and what it has cost. The one battle, Battle of the Bulge, 81,000 shot, finished. That's what liberty costs. Well, when anyone asks me to give my thoughts on, go to school, young kids, and talk to them about the Army or the Battle of the Bulge, I do it because I consider it necessary, and I consider it part of my function as an officer. Now, I was commissioned in 42. I took an oath. You know, you can retire from the military forces, but you're still under oath because you took an oath. I'm not a mister. I'm a lieutenant colonel. The mister went out when I took that oath.
Sir, I want to thank you so much for your service to our country, and I thank you very much for your time with us today. We greatly appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Alfred Shehab. He is a veteran of the Battle of the Bulge in World War II, specifically with the 38th Cavalry Reconnaissance Squadron. I'm Greg Corumbus. This has been Veterans Chronicles.